All right, so good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for taking your lunch hour to come and learn about Upgrade and what's new in the Windows 10 anniversary update. My name is Pallavi Dheeram, and I'm a program manager on the Windows deployment team at Microsoft. I joined Microsoft about 5 years ago after graduating from Georgia Tech, actually here in Atlanta. So it's always great to be back here. It reminds me of all the fun and not so fun times of being a poor grad student. All right, so in the last 5 years, I've worked on setup, I've worked on upgrade, I've worked on some migration tools, a lot of them in the consumer space, but for the last few months, I've been working on enterprise-specific features. And that journey has been a lot of fun, extremely challenging as well. So that's a little bit about me. I'd just like to know a little bit about you before I start my talk. So how many of you are actually working with machines that run Windows 10 already? That's a lot of you. Nice. What about Windows 7? Okay. Wait, did I double count that? Anyways. Or how about 8 and 8.1? All right, some of you there. Great, so I just wanted to know my audience so that for those of you who are on Windows 10, brilliant. I'm sure we've just released the Windows 10 anniversary update, and I'm sure you'd like to know about what happens in the whole upgrade process before you update to Windows 10 anniversary update. And for those of you who are on 7, I'm really hoping that this talk familiarizes you with this process of upgrade and encourages you to update to the Windows 10 anniversary update. So with that said, in the next 75 minutes, we're going to cover the following topics. There's going to be some terminology change. I'm sure a lot of you have heard the term feature updates and quality updates, so you know what these are, but we'll still do a recap. Then we'll talk about the common deployment technologies, dive into how feature updates work, what phases, what operations, what steps happen in each of these. Then we'll talk about how can you recover from a feature update, either during a feature update or after it. How do you recover a machine if you run into any issues? And then finally, we'll go into some tips and tricks on troubleshooting, as well as what's new in the anniversary update that would be interesting to you. We will have time for questions at the end, so I'd really appreciate if we could save the questions until the end. All right. So again, a quick recap of this. Many of you have already heard these terms, but what used to be called an OS upgrade, so new features, functionality, all the introduction of these are now called feature updates. On the other hand, any servicing-related fixes, so we're talking cumulative updates, bug fixes, security patches, patch Tuesday fixes, all of these now come under the term quality updates. So you have feature updates and quality updates, and I will be using the term feature updates moving forward in the deck. So upgrade or feature updates, as we've known them in the past, and as you've probably experienced, have been difficult at best. And that's what made wipe and load such a popular technology for deploying the latest operating system onto existing devices. So wipe and load includes your backing up of all the data that's on the machine, and then doing this time-consuming image customization, and then using that image to actually do a bare metal deployment. And once that's done, then the data is restored, apps are installed, drivers are installed, and finally, the machines are ready to run the latest operating system. Another way of getting the latest OS is to actually buy new hardware. So we've noticed that every 3 to 5 years in the enterprise space, there's a device refresh that happens. So you get new devices with the new operating system, the latest hardware. However, you have to keep in mind that there is a time lag between when we release the new operating system and when devices actually get manufactured and released with it. So if your enterprise is up for a device refresh, sure, it makes perfect sense to wait for the new devices with the latest OS. But if we're talking about existing devices in your enterprise, then now let Windows do the work for you. So let Windows take the burden of doing your migration or preserving the apps, drivers, data, and settings when it's updating from the new old operating system to the new OS. Which now brings us to the meat of the talk, which is how exactly do these feature updates work? What happens? What are the phases of this feature update? And I'd also like to add a point about feature updates. We've actually invested a ton in feature updates and made it more easy as well as resilient to failure. And we have hundreds of millions of consumer feature updates that have happened from Windows 7, 8, 8.1 to Windows 10, as well as those folks who are already on 10 and on the 10 update train. So feature updates essentially have four phases. You have the down level phase, you have the Windows RE or the Windows recovery environment phase. And then there's the first boot, which is literally the first time that we boot into the new operating system. And finally, the second boot, or what we call UBI boot. UBI stands for out-of-box experience here. So before we dive into the steps of these individual phases, let's quickly glance at the latest UX, or the user experience that you would see. Now, a lot of you might be using task sequences or might be skipping the UX of any kind, but for those of you with smaller number of machines or if you have to manually update the devices, then you would see this user experience. So there are two types of experiences here. There's your media-based, where you have the OS payload, you have the bits with you. And then there's the Windows update-based feature updates, where the payload needs to be downloaded. The experiences are slightly different between the two. So if it's a media-based, you'll see this purple screen until the reboot, and then your progress UX shows up. And in the Windows update-based experience, it's slightly different until you reboot for the first time. But from there onwards, the progress UX that you see is actually unified between media and Windows update. Okay, so let's talk about the first phase of the update, which is your down-level phase. Now, in the down-level phase, we have something called setup, which you must be familiar with, which runs. Now, setup is your orchestrator of the entire feature update. So setup makes sure that your device is ready to update to Windows 10. So the very first thing that it does is make sure that the device is even capable of running Windows 10. And those are called the system requirement checks. Now, I will dive into the different details of these four points here, but I want to go through them first. So once we do the system requirement checks and we know your machine can run Windows 10, then we check for disk space. Now, disk space is slightly different if it's a media-based versus a Windows update-based feature update, because in one case, you have the bits. In the other case, you need to download the bits. So we need that additional space to download. So in the Windows update-based case, you have two sets of disk space checks that happen. You have the pre-download to make sure that there's enough amount of space to download the payload. And then you have the pre-install disk space check to make sure that you can install Windows 10. Once that's done, we have the next step, which is called dynamic update. So dynamic updates ensure that you have the latest and greatest operating system when you reach the desktop on the other side, as well as you have the latest and greatest binary of setup itself to run the update. So that includes fixes as well as updates for both the OS as well as the setup binary. And then you have the full application and device compat scan. So this is to make sure that all the apps and devices on your machine are capable of, are compatible with Windows 10, and those of which are not are basically prompted up or shown to you. So let's go into some of the details here. For system requirement checks, the first thing that we check is your processor. Is it compatible with Windows 10? Does it have the right set of features to run Windows 10 to its full potential? As well as, can it run it securely? So that's what's checked for the CPU. Then we check for the RAM requirements. So the RAM requirements haven't really changed. It's still 1 gig for 32-bit operating systems and 2 gigs for the 64-bit operating system. Then we also check that there is a small bare minimum amount of space on the system reserved partition. So your system reserved partition basically contains the boot-related files, and this can actually be filled up by the OEMs or by some sort of a recovery or security piece. So we need to make sure that there's some bare minimum amount of space here for us to be able to update the system reserved partition. Then we check for the mode of operation. Is the machine running in safe mode, in audit mode? In that case, we abort the update. And finally, we have other checks like, is it a boot from VHD? Is it a Windows to Go stick? And we can't update any of those devices. So that's the system requirement check. Once that's done, like I mentioned, we have the disk space checks. So in Windows 10, we introduced the ability to use external storage to account or to do the update for low disk space devices. Now, a lot of you might have machines that have plenty of space on them, so this is targeted towards those smaller devices like the 16 gig or 32-bit devices that actually don't have enough space to update and can't really be freed up of too much space. This is something, it's a feature that you can take the most advantage of in like the Windows Update based or Windows Update connected scenarios. And even if you use external storage, we need some amount of bare minimum space on the OS drive to be able to continue with the update. This is anywhere between 500 megs to a gig of space. But we need that amount of space to be able to continue even if you're using external storage. So that's something to keep in mind here. Then you have the dynamic update phase. Like I mentioned, dynamic updates are, again, there are two phases to it. One brings down the fixes to the setup binary itself to make sure that you're running the latest version of it. So that's the first step that happens. And then the second phase of DU, or dynamic update, is to make sure that your latest drivers, your cumulative updates, any critical component fixes, the language packs, all of these can come down through dynamic update. Again, this is enabled by default in your VU-connected scenarios. I believe in SECM, there is actually an option to enable dynamic update. It's disabled by default, but you have an option to enable this. So we would connect to a temporary, we would temporarily connect to the Windows Update server to get these fixes down. And finally, the full app and device scan. So there are a set of compatibility databases that we carry along with us. And this is carried along with setup, actually. These databases contain all the information that we know about different apps and drivers in the ecosystem, and which ones are compatible, which ones are not compatible, which ones are hard blocked, whether there are any mitigations for these apps from the app vendors. So all of that information is stored in these databases. Now, when we bring down dynamic update for setup, we can also update these compatibility databases. And they do get updated pretty often depending on the compatibility state of the apps. So it's that database is pretty dynamic at that point. So at this point, we've basically, setup has decided what apps can be migrated, what cannot be migrated, what drivers can move, what drivers are not compatible, whether we can actually do an update on the system or not. It also can, it also decides by this point as to what edition of the new operating system should be installed or what product key should be used. All of these factors are determined by setup. And then we kick off the install process. So the install process includes one major operation called gather. So gather makes sure that all the apps, all the drivers, data, settings that are on your old OS are actually inventoried so that we know what to migrate to the new operating system. Now here when I mention drivers, they're not just the ones that are associated with the devices that are currently connected to your machine. So every device leaves behind a driver trail, and then we make sure that those drivers are also inventoried in the process. Along with that, setup is aware of BitLocker, so it knows how to suspend BitLocker during the update process. And with the anniversary update, we actually included support for third-party encryption as well. So there are some steps to take here, but third-party encryption software also can be supported, and you can update the machine. So I will go into details of that, so bear with me on that one. All right, so at this point, we're ready to reboot the system for the first time. And we boot into what's called the Windows recovery environment. So your Windows recovery environment is, it has a slight more functionality as compared to Windows PE, which probably a lot of you know. So Windows RE has, it's this minimalistic sort of environment that knows how to continue with the update process, but if something goes wrong, then it can also provide that recoverability and restore the old OS in its pristine state. For those of you who know the term safe OS, this is basically the safe OS that we're using here. So Windows RE and safe OS, same thing here. So once we boot into Windows RE, we lay down the new operating system. The interesting part here is that neither the new operating system nor the old OS are actually running. Both of them are offline, so both of them are now files and folder hierarchies. So you can actually start moving things around. So this is where the migration process actually begins. Now, once the new OS is laid down, all the drivers that we inventoried in the down-level phase, those are injected into the new system's driver store. Once that is done, along with that, your old OS is all stashed away in this directory called windows.old. And windows.old basically provides that recoverability aspect where you can, if something goes wrong, you swap out this new operating system with windows.old, and your old operating system is back and functioning. So now we've prepped the operating system, or we've prepped the system to boot into the new OS for the first time. And that's your first boot phase. So in the first boot phase, the very first operation is sysprep specialize. So this is where we bind your new operating system with the machine itself and give it an identity here. Once this happens, then we install the drivers. Now, the drivers that were injected in the driver store, out of those, the right set of drivers are chosen, and then these are actually installed on the OS. And also, apps are migrated at this point. There are also system settings that we migrate from the old operating system to the new OS. Now imagine your operating system, this new one that was basically, it was a bare vanilla operating system, now is fully loaded with all the apps, the drivers, and system settings. So we want to make sure that this fully loaded OS can actually boot correctly and cleanly. And that's why we have this phase called the second boot phase, which makes sure that the device can actually boot properly with all of these things loaded on it. And once that happens, then we migrate the user data and the user settings, and we're done with the process of migration at this point. So now we transition into what's called the out-of-box experience. Now, your out-of-box experience is basically, it gives you an opportunity to configure your new operating system in certain ways. So it gives you an option of express settings versus customizing a set of settings, or it tells you about Cortana, it gives you information about the new apps for the functionality in Windows 10, and so on and so forth. So that's the sort of information it gives you here. A lot of you could be using some sort of a command line parameter to skip the out-of-box experience. If you do pass that, we will respect that parameter, so you won't see any UBI experience. Similarly, if you're already on Windows 10 and you're staying on the Windows 10 update train, again, you won't see any UBI experience. So those of you who will actually see it are the ones who are updating from 7, 8, or 8.1 and haven't passed any command line parameter here. For the rest of you, the user actually lands on the login screen, logs in, and then shortly reaches the desktop, and that's the end of the update process. Simple, right? Four phases. So we prep the system for the update, we lay down the safe OS, and we make sure that the migration process starts. We boot for the first time into the new operating system, install drivers and apps, and finally boot into this fully loaded operating system and migrate user data and settings. So a little bit about what's migrated and what's not. Like I mentioned, it's apps, drivers, data, and settings. So the apps that are compatible with Windows 10 or that have been provided with some sort of an automatic remediation, those are migrated across. The apps that are not compatible and don't have any sort of mitigation, those ones are actually blocked by the update process. You will be asked to uninstall these apps to be able to proceed forward. Along with that, the inbox UWP apps, the universal apps, those are not migrated across. The reason is that the new OS already has the latest versions of these apps. Now, keep in mind here that the app data and the settings, those are migrated across. So those won't be lost anywhere. They will be migrated. It's just the app itself that actually just transitions into this new app. Now, speaking of drivers, again, all drivers that are compatible with Windows 10, all of those are migrated across. Again, inbox drivers are not migrated for the same reason that we have the latest versions of these inbox drivers in the new operating system. Now, all data under user profiles, under public profiles, these are migrated. There's some data which is not moved around at all during this whole process of update, and though that data is actually preserved wherever it is. And finally, settings. So all settings are migrated by default. There are certain ones that are explicitly marked as don't migrate, so those ones are not migrated. Otherwise, we should be migrating all settings by default. Now, what blocks the update? So again, as I mentioned, apps that don't have any automatic remediation, those ones are blocked by the update process. The setup process will error out. It will let you know what are the apps that need to be uninstalled before you move forward with the update process. In terms of drivers, we have a set of boot critical drivers, and drivers can be marked boot critical, but there are two common classes. You have your network and the storage class drivers. So we want to make sure that we're able to read the disk on the other side. So that's why we need the storage class drivers, and DJ network is extremely critical, so we need the network drivers as well. So these are considered boot critical. Now, if these are incompatible with Windows 10, the ones that already existed on your old operating system, and there is no replacement for it, so there's no new driver that's been provided that is compatible with Windows 10, then that will essentially block the update process. So again, this is a hard block, and the update basically aborts at that point. All right. So what are your options to recover a machine either during the feature update or after a feature update if something goes wrong? So you have three options here. There's rollback, there's what we call uninstall, and then there's reset. So rollback is during the feature update. So let me actually move to the rollback slide here. So rollback is during your feature update. If something goes wrong, then rollback kicks in automatically and makes sure that all the update-related operations are undone. And then finally restores your old OS to its pristine state. And this is actually available in every phase of the update. So let's look at the different phases here. You have the down-level phase. So in the down-level phase, we haven't really moved anything around. So there are a bunch of setup operations that have happened. These are cleaned up if something goes wrong and your system is back and functioning like it was, like nothing ever happened there. However, if it rebooted into the Windows RE phase, then the first thing that happens is the system boots back into the old operating system, and then any update-related operations are cleaned up at that point. In the first and second boot phases, where you're booting into the new operating system, again, we take a step backwards, so that's basically booting into the Windows RE environment and then undoing the update-related operations. And once that's done, then we boot back into the old OS, clean up, and make sure that it's in the pristine state. So that's how we make sure that rollback restores your system in every phase of the update. Now, this is during a feature update. What about after a feature update? Let's say you updated successfully, and you realized you don't like this new operating system for whatever reason. Maybe it doesn't make you as productive as you were, or you don't like some UX aspect of it, or it's just not functioning correctly. At that point, you have the option of uninstall, and this is also called go back to the previous OS. So this is user initiated, and you will find this in the settings UI of Windows 10. If you go to the update and recovery section, there's a recovery tab that has this go back to either, it says go back to your Windows 7 or Windows 8 or 8.1 if you're on one of those OSs. If you were already on Windows 10 when you started the update, it just says go back to an earlier build. So this functionality or this capability is available for up to 10 days after you install your feature update for the Windows 10 anniversary update. If you're still thinking of updating to Windows 10 November update, then you have up to 31 days to decide if you like this new OS or if you just want to go back to the previous one. Now, there are a couple of things to keep in mind with uninstall. The user on the machine who initiates the uninstall needs to be an admin, as well as you can initiate uninstall only locally for that particular machine. There's no remote way of actually initiating an uninstall. So those are two things to keep in mind here. And then finally, you have reset. So reset basically allows you to keep your new operating system, but gives you a clean start or a fresh start on this new OS. So again, this is user initiated. You will find it in the same location where you found uninstall. And apps and settings in this particular case are not preserved. You have the option of keeping the data. So this is available anytime after a successful feature update. Keep in mind here, this does not take you back to the previous operating system. It leaves you on the same new OS, but in a pristine state. I'm sorry? I think so, yes. So I will take questions in just a bit, so just give me a second here. All right, we get these questions a lot, so I thought I'd put it in my slides. Do we support cross-architecture feature updates? That is, do we convert, can we actually do an update from 32-bit Win 7 to 64-bit Windows 10? And the answer is no, we don't do this, we don't support it. The main reason, basically, is your apps as well as drivers. So app vendors actually configure the different architecture apps to have different functionality. So if we change the architecture under the hood, this functionality will get affected. Similarly, you have custom drivers, and these, again, are different for 32-bit as well as 64-bit operating system. So again, if we change the architecture, the behavior of these drivers is affected. So that's why we don't support this. Now, the next one is about converting BIOS to UEFI during the update process. So no, we don't have support for this today, but we have this in a list of items that we would start exploring. But how many of you actually feel that that's a useful feature where we can do the disk conversion? Okay. That's an overwhelming number. So, okay, we'll start exploring options for this particular one. All right, and this is a question that comes pretty often. How much of free disk space do I need to install the Windows 10 anniversary update? And I really wish I could have a hard number for you, but it varies from device to device. So during the process of the feature update, setup actually calculates the amount of space that's required for the install. And this is based on like what updates have been downloaded, the size of those, et cetera. So all of that is taken into account when setup actually calculates this install disk space, and it varies according to your hardware and software configuration of the device. So it's not a hard number that we can provide here. Okay, so let's move into a little bit of troubleshooting. So there are two types of failures. You have the down-level failures and you have rollbacks. So down-level failures are literally the failures that happen in the down-level phase. So we haven't rebooted at all and something goes wrong and we get back to the OS as it was. Or the other one are rollbacks, which is you're in the Windows RE phase, or you're in the first boot or second boot phases, and something goes wrong there, and we need to restore the previous OS. So those are your two types of failures. Now, a great starting point in terms of the logs for any failures is your setup ACT or setup act.log. So every time setup runs, it creates this folder called $windows.tildebt, and this folder has all of the logs related to setup and related to the update process. Now, your rollback and down-level failures, a great starting point, like I mentioned, is the setup act log under the Panther folder. So there are two subfolders here. There's your Panther folder, and there's your rollback folder. So your Panther folder has, the setup act log has all the operations that happened during the update process. And the rollback setup act.log has all the information about when the rollback kicks off, all that information. So those would be great starting points for both rollback and down-level failures. For uninstall, again, your rollback setup act.log is something that's a great starting point. Now, you have UBI-specific logs, post-update issue-specific logs, as well as memory dumps that are for either fatal errors or some sort of bug checks that are located in your rollback folder as well. Now, along with these logs, there's also another set of logs that are useful if there's some sort of a device or driver crash or hang, and those are your device install logs. So the device install logs are located in separate locations based on whether it's during a rollback or otherwise, and these are the locations of the setup or the device install logs. Now, reading error codes. So if you look at a setup_act.log in the rollback folder, for example, you will see that we provide the error code in terms of two pieces. You have the error code itself, and there's this hex-based, both of them are hex-based, actually, and then you have this extended code. So your error code is what setup actually catches, the Win32 code itself. Now, if setup can't catch the exact Win32 code for a rollback, it has a generic C19-00101 error code. So that and then your extended code basically gives you an idea of what phase and what operation was going on when this particular issue was encountered. So if it's 20017 here, you divide it as phase 2 and operation 17. So the phases are simple enough. 1 stands for down level, 2 stands for Windows RE, 3 is first boot, and 4 is second boot. So that is simple enough. The operations, of course, are a little more complicated because we have many more operations here. So 17 in this particular case is the boot operation. And I actually have included the conversion of what these numbers are to what these operations or phases are in the archive slides, so you could take a look there. So now we know that this is a rollback that happened in the Windows RE phase during the boot operation. So that's how you would basically read this code. At this point, I'm just going to get some water. All right. So let's talk about common rollback codes. So I know the slide is a little verbose, but bear with me here. So these are some of the common rollback error codes that we see for feature updates. So your 20017, again, is the boot operation in the Windows RE phase, something went wrong. So typical causes for this or common causes are driver hangs or crashes. So we have a process where we're trying to reflect a driver and something goes wrong in that process, then you would see this sort of an error code. Or if there's some sort of BCD corruption that's being caused during the update process, you would end up with this sort of an error code. Now, the setup_act logs, of course, are great to start with for both Panther as well as rollback, but also a setup crash dump, if it exists, would be extremely helpful in diagnosing what the issue could have been. Now, in this case, a workaround that could help is try booting into media itself. And if you're able to boot into media and read the disk, then there could be something in the update process that's causing an issue. However, if that's not the case, then there could be a greater problem of like disk corruption, or maybe there's a BIOS update that's required. Any of those steps are required here. Now for the 30018, this is your sysprep operation, and in the first boot phase. So this again, if you note, if you remember, in the first boot, we're actually installing drivers, right? So driver hangs and crashes are a common cause of rollbacks in this phase. So here, along with your setup_act logs, and a setup memory dump would be extremely useful to help us diagnose what the culprit is here. Now, keep in mind that you will have a memory dump only if, like, if there was a driver crash. If there was a hang and that needed you to manually reboot the system, then we will not have this memory dump, in which case the device install logs could be really helpful. So the setup api.dev.log could give us an idea about what the list of drivers that were being installed are and what was the current driver that was being installed when this problem happened. So I do have some notes later, but basically in this setup api.dev.log, if you find a section that has started but hasn't completed with some sort of an exit code, then that particular driver could be the culprit. Again, this is, it could be the culprit or it could be waiting for another device install to finish. So these are some things to keep in mind when you're looking at these logs, if you're looking at these logs. Then we have the 40017. So this is your boot operation in the second boot phase. So keep in mind here, second boot, so we've already installed all the apps, we've installed the drivers, we've migrated system settings. So when we boot for the first time into this new OS, there could be something wrong with the apps, or there could be something wrong, or a driver crash, or a driver hang. So typical causes here are antivirus software, or filter drivers, or other driver hangs or crashes. So here again, the memory dump would be really useful to figure out what's going wrong. And a couple of workarounds here are basically if you could suspend the antivirus software and then try the update, or if a particular driver is causing problems, remove that driver and try the update, or do what we call clean boot. Clean boot is basically turn off anything except the critical functionality. So I'm sure a lot of you are aware with this clean boot option. So you could try that, and if that works, then you know then there's some problem with a particular driver. And finally, there's your 300, 3000D or 4000D. So this is data migration operation in the first or the second boot phases. So the common causes here are either disk corruption or some particular file was trying to be migrated from the old to the new OS, and you got an access denied error, for example. So this is the type of error, this is the error code that you would see if that sort of an issue happened. So if we can identify the file, which we can from the setup logs, then we can remove that file and try the update and see if it's successful. So these are things to just keep in mind in terms of some amount of self-diagnosis, but also mainly for if you contact support with an issue, then you know that these are the kind of logs or these are the kind of information that they would require or they would find helpful to be able to troubleshoot or diagnose the issue. So that said, I'm actually going to move into what's next or what's come out in the Windows 10 anniversary update that's useful. And this is something that I mentioned a few slides before, and I asked you to bear with me. So let's get into that. Let's talk about feature updates with third-party encryption. So at Windows 10 launch, as a lot of you probably painfully know, we didn't have support or any support for drives that were encrypted with third-party software. So if they were encrypted with BitLocker, great. We knew BitLocker, we knew how to suspend BitLocker, the update was successful. If the drive was encrypted with a third-party encryption software, however, the update would basically roll back. So during the November update timeframe, we actually worked with a couple of ISVs to come up with a scripting solution here. So that basically required you to mount the Vim, run their script on the Vim that would essentially inject the encryption drivers, and then use this Vim to do the update process. So if you did that, the update would work. If that didn't happen, or that of your particular ISV didn't support or didn't have a scripting solution, then the update would fail. So we got a lot of feedback in terms of we don't want to modify the Vim in any which way before actually doing the update. So give us something that we're used to, give us something that we commonly use in the enterprise. So we came up with this command line parameter called reflect drivers. Now reflect drivers is different from install drivers, so don't get confused there. But reflect drivers basically takes as input a path to the folder that contains these encryption drivers. So it's basically your inf-based drivers, so your encryption drivers, their infs. Once these are in a folder, in a flat structured folder, and once this path is passed on to setup via the reflect drivers flag, then these drivers get reflected in the down-level phase into the driver store. So when you boot into WinRE, these drivers are loaded, and these drivers can now read the disk so the process of update can continue, so it doesn't roll back. So that's about the new reflect drivers flag. So we've actually worked with ISVs on this particular one to test this to make sure it works. So please contact your ISV to find out if they actually support this. They should have documentation for it or some sort of instructions about how you go ahead with the path of the folder itself. So please contact your ISVs to get to know about this one. Speaking of command line parameters, these are some of the common command line parameters that you can use to configure the update. Now, the entire list is located in this link that's below, but some of the common ones allow you to choose your migration choice. They allow you to run the setup in UI-less mode. They allow you to not reboot the system if you don't want it to reboot for the first time, and so on and so forth. You can install drivers from a particular folder. You can install language packs from a particular folder. So these are all options that we provide so you have more control on your feature updates and what needs to be installed. Now, another way of actually using these command line parameters is something that we introduced in Windows 10 Anniversary Update, and that's your setupconfig.ini file. So your setupconfig.ini file is basically a configuration file. It takes all these command line parameters that you would pass manually and puts them into a file. And once the path of this file is passed to setup, or setup knows where this file is, then it will respect all those parameters and configure the update based on that. So here's what a setupconfig file looks like. So you just have the setupconfig.ini. There are two available formats here. So if you have setup.exe, WAC no reboot, WAC show ubi none, WAC telemetry enable, if that's your command line, then the equivalent for that is this setupconfig file. So you can either pass them in this format where you have the forward slash and the space and the option. So that's basically how you would pass your command line parameters. Or you have the second format where you have this equal to sign, and that's how you kind of put your parameters there. So your parameters in this file can be added, edited, modified, removed, any of those things. And setup will basically look at this file and say, OK, these are the parameters that need to be passed, and this is how I will configure the update. Now, this is especially useful when it comes to WSUS type of updates or WOO kind of updates, Windows Update-based updates. So setup actually looks for this file in a very specific location. So this is the location where it looks at. And in that case, obviously, there's no manual way of like launching setup.exe with a bunch of command line parameters. So you can drop the setup config file in this location, and setup will look at these parameters and configure your update. Now, in media-based updates, you can simply pass the path of this file via the config file parameter to setup.exe, and the rest of the parameters can live in this configuration file. So those are the two ways of using setupconfig.ini and it doesn't require any additional step when it comes to WSAS type of updates. So, with that, in the last 1 hour, I hope you learned more about upgrade than you knew before this, but we went through the process of how a feature update works, what are the different phases, what are the different operations, and how do you recover from a failure during or after a feature update. And then we looked at some of the options or some troubleshooting tips and tricks here in terms of like what are the logs we look at, what are the common issues, and then finally, this third-party encryption and update. So we really hope that you try out this updates with third-party encryption. Let us know your feedback. Let us know of any issues that you run into. And it's also my humble request to evaluate this session. Let us know if it's been helpful, if the content is useful to you. And with that, thank you for your time. And I will take questions now. So. Yes, you can. So the windows.old folder would, after the 10 days, would get removed automatically. We have a scheduled task for that. So that's one way of getting rid of it. Sorry. You could run disk cleanup on the device, and that has an option for like the previous installation files, so you could remove Windows out all that way. Through disk cleanup, that is.
Excuse me.
Go ahead.
Yes, can you speak to, you know, a lot of us are going to be migrating to UEFI and Secure Boot, so, you know, converting to GPT disk. Can you speak to proper disk partitioning as it pertains to going to UEFI and the importance of the recovery partition and whether it's required or optional? So, yeah.
So just to understand your question, it's basically if we want to convert BIOS to UEFI, then yep. what exactly would be done in that process?
Yeah, slightly so, but also maybe speaking, emphasizing the importance of the recovery partition. Is it required? Is it optional? And what are the ramifications of either way?
So we actually haven't explored that option yet. It's something that we will start exploring, so I won't have too much of details
okay.
on that. So
no problem.
Apologies for that. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have a question regarding dynamic update. In our environment, the setup exit process cannot access internet. So is there a way to maybe inject the dynamic update compatibility list into the image or SCCM package without...
Do you have the ability to download the updates like from a WSAS server or from some server?
Yeah, but you can't really see the dynamic updates. You know, we want to update the setup binaries that you talked about, and I have never seen those on VSAS.
Sure, but if you're able to download the updates in one location at least, then you can offline inject those updates into your media.
Okay.
So you can do that in that case.
Okay.
Does that answer the question?
Yeah, it kind of makes sense, but I've never seen dynamic updates and setup binaries, anything related to that. Is it part of the cumulative updates?
Do you want to repeat that? Sorry. So if you basically, I think what Irene is saying is, if you have security updates, then you will be able to download the dynamic updates. She said that, the update model is now cumulative updates. So if you're downloading any of the security updates, then you would get the other updates, the dynamic updates along with that. Thanks. Thanks, Irene.
If you're using the uninstall switch disable, is it the same functionality in the Woo download and the ISO exactly the same if you use USB or setup, you know, and the download option if you were to change the command line? Is it the same functionality in two pieces? One, in the ability to go back where it's now blocked out so you can't do it? And number two, is the windows.old automatically removed at a specific time?
So the windows.old is removed at a specific time. So after 10 days, which is the available time for uninstall, that folder is removed after that.
But you disable it. Or if you use the uninstall disable, then why keep the windows.old?
Let me follow up on that. So let me actually get in touch with you offline, and I'll follow up on that question for sure. I'm not sure if it's immediately removed when we disable the uninstall capability. So I'll get back to you on that one.
So I've got a question about Windows to Go. You
sure.
specified that you can't do an in-place upgrade for Windows to Go. So essentially, unless we go to LTSB on Windows to Go, we're limiting the lifetime of a potential Windows to Go stick to 18 months, roughly.
Sure.
Are there any plans to make it where that can actually run on Windows, the feature updates can run on Windows to Go?
Currently, I'm not aware of any plans for that. Currently I'm not aware. It's not a supported scenario.
Okay.
So, thanks.
So there's certain apps we don't want people to run, so we've removed them that come with Windows 10. But like when the anniversary set came back out, it reinstalled them.
So your question is, are there apps that are automatically removed during the update process, and do they get reinstalled?
Yeah, so we remove Xbox, but during the reinstall of the anniversary, Xbox reappeared. So I didn't know if it's looking to see what's there first, or it just does a dump of all the new updated stuff.
I didn't quite get your question.
That's what we did. Okay, that's what we did. I don't know if there's
a... Okay.
Yeah, that's what we did. I just didn't know if there's a...
So, and there was on that there was a comment that you're hoping to be able through just standard upgrades, feature upgrades, that you'll detect which apps are not currently installed and not to reinstall those in the future. Is that on the roadmap somewhere?
We know about the apps that are on your device.
For example, if I remove Xbox, I remove mail, whatever I can remove, right? When I do a feature upgrade, is there plans for the setup to detect which apps are not there and not to reinstall them during the feature upgrade?
There is a plan, apparently. Yeah.
Currently, but in the future, they just nod their heads yes.
Do you want to go ahead?
Right. Yeah. If we're planning on using SCCM and the servicing option to upgrade our Windows 10, like Windows 10 Anniversary, can we use that with third-party encryption? Do you know?
Can you use the SCCM?
And the servicing plan option for WSUS to upgrade even if we have third-party encryption. Is there any incompatibilities there?
So are there any incompatibilities if you're updating using WSUS or using SCCM with disk encryption?
Well, we have third-party encryption on ours instead of BitLocker. Is there any issues with using that?
Right, so you would need to use the same setup config INI method and basically pass this reflect drivers flag in that with the folder of drivers.
My question would be regarding the same BitLocker. What would be the impact of the in-place upgrade for all of the machines in the organization?
What's the impact of...
For example, the users are using BitLocker encryption for the devices. So what is the impact of having an in-place upgrade for all those users?
There is no impact because we suspend BitLocker when we're doing the update process, and then we re-enable it once we're on the other side, once we're done with the offline phase. So there should be no impact to any of the devices.
Okay, so this means there is no need for the MBAM to put over there and do the re-encryption again?
No, no.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. For BitLocker, you don't even need the reflect driver's flag. You're good to go.
If you're using provisioning packages via Wicked and you apply them to an OS, say it's like a driver or something like that, and you now upgrade and the feature or the driver is not supported, or maybe it is supported somewhat, does it affect the provisioning package because the provisioning package has specific data that's related to the driver? And if you change that, does it try to uninstall the provisioning package?
So actually, I'm not the expert on Wicked, but if you can shoot me an email, I can give you my card. If you can shoot me an email, then I'll confirm from the person who knows about this and get back.
Okay.
So, thanks.
My question is, when I upgrade Windows 10, every time it upgrades, I lose my RSAT tools when there's actually a build change. Is there a reason for that? We have to keep reinstalling the RSAT tools for administration?
You need to install, I'm sorry, which tools?
The RSAT tools. It's the administration tools for servers.
Okay.
Every time you...
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, okay. So if... I guess if you don't have dynamic update, then you need to install anything that's optional on... You'll have to reinstall anything that's optional on the machine.
Because it should migrate with the system, at least. I feel it should migrate with the system instead of having to do that every time there's a build change.
Agree. it's... Something that's on our list or on our radar for what we're thinking about for future releases. So stay tuned.
With third-party encryption, is there a way to convert from third-party encryption to BitLocker during the upgrade process?
Not that I'm aware of. So you mean like, can you just convert the encryption?
So you'd have to decrypt and then re-encrypt?
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Hi. I've noticed every time I've done an upgrade with Windows 10, if Hyper-V is enabled, I'm running into problems. And it seems to be like with the first Windows 10 version and when the anniversary update came through, anytime the upgrade came, we had Hyper-V enabled, we had problems. So I don't know, is there a known issue with Hyper-V enabled on Windows 10?
Do we have known issues with Hyper-V? No, I'm not aware of these issues. But if we can talk and if you could like send me logs or let me know what the issue is, maybe I'd be able to help.
It was too different, but I could talk to you offline about it.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi. Do you know what third-party encryption tools are supported? Or is there a list?
So we've worked with some of them. We've worked with McAfee. We've worked with Checkpoint, Symantec, Dell, Toshiba, Deslock. So they should have support. There are also other, but if there's a particular ISP you're working with and they don't, then they can probably contact us and try to find out how to support this.
Okay, thanks. So.
Okay. All right, thanks everyone. And you can catch me downstairs, I'll be right here, so thank you.